So yeah, after a brief recap, I want to talk about how you form composite models. And in order to do that, we're going to have to revisit a topic, or not revisit, but visit for the first time a topic that in the notes is back all the way back in section one, but I've been sort of skipping in the interests of time. But now we really need it. And that's the idea of what constitutes an appropriate mapping or morphism between models. So we'll talk about morphisms and composites, as you'll see those kind of go together. And then I want to talk about how you linearize composites, and for that matter, morphisms. So linearizing all of that. And then at the end, if we have time, and I'm told we have to vacate the room by quarter after at the very, very latest, because there are people coming in, so we, you know, who knows, may or may not get here. I want to give you just a very brief preview of one direction in which this story goes after this point. Let me also remind everybody that there is a kind of a list of possible topics in the Dropbox folder, and you know, any feedback from people on what they'd like to hear about in April would be really, really welcome. So, you know, do take a look and let me know what appeals, and we'll try to do it sort of democratically. Okay. So last time, we were talking about non-signaling probability weights, and more generally, or maybe less generally, non-signaling states. And we also kind of did define two possible models, two very, very simple models of what you might call a non-signaling composite of two models, two probabilistic models. So we had two very simple composite models. I'll put that in quotes because I haven't formally defined what that means. But these will turn out to be examples. One was what I called A cross B, and then I put a little NS down here to remind us that it's non-signaling. This is probably the simplest thing that you could imagine. This is the model in which the test space going with this model is the so-called, well, it's just the Cartesian product, sorry, of the two test spaces, which doesn't literally mean the Cartesian product. It means the set of Cartesian products of tests belonging to each of the two test spaces, like that. So it's let's say the set of product tests, the set of tests that represent experiments in which Alice makes a measurement E, Bob makes a measurement F, and there you go. That's the measurement. The outcomes are ordered pairs. Alice sees little X, Bob sees little Y. That's it. Okay, and then the states were basically the set, I'm going to call it omega NS, of non-signaling probability weights, little omega on MA cross MB, with the extra property that the marginals live in the appropriate state spaces on the two wings. So omega 1, the first marginal, isn't just a probability weight on A, it's one of the designated weights that is a state on A. And similarly for omega 2, that's in the state space of B. All right. Before I mention the other model, let me pause here and ask if people are okay with what is a non-signaling probability weight. Do you want a quick recap of that? Or is that clear enough? Right. So let me just put it over here in case. omega, that's a, pardon me, a probability weight on, say, MA cross MB is non-signaling if and only if the marginals, say, omega 1, whose value at x is the sum over all the y's in some test f that Bob could do of omega xy, is independent of f. And ditto on the other side, omega sub 2 of y, sum over all the little x's in E of omega xy, is independent of E, where here E is in MA, and F's in MB. Okay, so those are the non-signaling probability weights, the ones with those sort of well-defined marginals, test-independent marginals, and here we're just asking that those marginals actually live in the right places, that's all. And then we had a slightly fancier version, which I called AB surmounted by a two-headed arrow. That's the bilateral product, or the Foulis-Randall product. And it differs from the first one only in that it has a slightly larger test space like that, same set of states, and this just consists of tests that rather than being simple product tests allow for some one-way classical signaling in one or the other direction so that the test that Bob makes could depend on Alice's outcome or vice versa. But that the only difference here is that in this case, you are inserting the non-signaling condition by hand, whereas here, this enforces non-signaling, right? So the probability weights on this test space are the non-signaling probability weights. Hey, okay, so, all right, so now let me, I guess I should just stop, you know, sort of ask, are there any questions at this point? Because if not, I want to advertise an inadequacy of both of these ways of forming composites. They're useful, but they're not really adequate. Yes?
Could you choose some bigger data space for this second model?
Could you choose a bigger... Oh, I'm sorry. Actually, I've made a mistake. I want to choose a smaller state space. What I actually want here is not just that the marginals are in the right place. I want all the conditional states to be in the right place. That implies that the marginals are in the right places, but not conversely. So that you actually do want this as well. So thank you for your question, even though the answer is no. I want to go the other direction. So what did you have in mind by a larger state space?
No, I was just asking because you're imposing non-signaling in the right distribution. Mm-hmm. So I was just asking what else can you do in the state space?
Yeah, not much. I mean, actually, this relates to what I was about to say, which is, please notice that the outcome spaces for these two models are the same, and they're just the set of ordered pairs of outcomes. In other words, they're just the Cartesian product of the outcome space for A and the outcome space for B. And that's way too small. That's clearly just not adequate to capture the kinds of composites that we actually do build in quantum mechanics, or for that matter, in classical probability theory. So let me amplify on that by discussing how those composites work. So let's start with the quantum case. In quantum mechanics, just simple non-relativistic quantum mechanics, if I have models associated with two Hilbert spaces, so I've got a model, you know, A, which is the frame manual of some Hilbert space H, and the you know, the set of states coming from the density operators on H, and B is the same thing coming from some other Hilbert space, maybe K. Then the usual quantum sort of composite model, let me just call it AB, is what? It's the model that you get by forming the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces and then proceeding as usual. So it's the quantum model associated with that tensor product. And what's the outcome space of this? Well, remember the sort of oversimplified, but for our purposes adequate, model of a quantum experiment is an orthonormal basis. So this is all the orthonormal bases on the tensor product, and the elements of an orthonormal basis are unit vectors. What unit vectors? All unit vectors. So the outcome space for this is the unit sphere of H tensor K, which is way bigger than the Cartesian product of the two unit spheres, right? It contains all sorts of entangled outcomes, you might say. Right. You can have linear superpositions of products of vectors, tensor products of vectors. Yile, are you okay? You look like you have a question somehow.
Yes. So when you say the outcome, it's on the left. Yeah, the outcome space is just x8 times xp.
Yes.
Does it apply to both?
Yes. Yes. Because over here, what are the tests? They're things that, you know, look like maybe that. But that itself is a set of ordered pairs. And you're just taking a union of a bunch of sets of ordered pairs. That's a set of ordered pairs. And the test going the other way also.
So are these two definitions equivalent?
Not quite. Because here, you, even though you have the same outcomes, you have fewer sets of outcomes that qualify as experiments here. They're only things that look like this,
okay.
Sort of independent measurements. And over here, you have more possible experiments or measurements because you are allowed to let Bob's measurement depend on Alice's outcome, or going the other way, Alice's choice of measurement could depend on Bob's. And that enlarged test space is interesting mainly just because having that many tests enforces non-signaling. Means all the probability weights are not signaling. You don't have to put that condition in by hand. So it's useful in that way. Okay?
Thanks.
You're welcome. Okay, yes, Ian.
Is there an intuition as to what the test space would be in which it doesn't fit into the smaller model, but it does fit into the larger model? I'm struggling to visualize.
What sort of test spaces might be in between the two?
Yes.
Like these two over here?
Might be bigger than...
Or what might be bigger than this, even?
Yep.
Yes. One thing you could do, I'm not even going to write this down, but you could say, I know what the states are that I want, so why don't I just throw in every possible set of ordered pairs, every subset of the Cartesian product, over which all those states add up to one, and just declare those to be measurements. Mathematically, that's fine. I think the issue is, what's the physical rationale for saying absolutely anything like that is a performable measurement? Okay. So we all agree that for quantum purposes, these guys are not going to work, right? Because you have too few outcomes. This is what you want. Let's look at the classical case quickly. This is also of some interest. By classical here, I mean the full-blown sort of measure theoretic version in which the model A consists of the set of partitions of some measurable space by measurable subsets coming from some sigma algebra sigma, and where we're just using all the probability weights for our states. B is the same thing, but maybe coming from a different measurable space. Again, use all the probability weights. What's the usual model for a composite in that case? Well, the usual story is that you take the Cartesian product of these two measurable spaces, and for measurable sets, you use not the Cartesian product of sigma and sigma prime. The Cartesian product of two Boolean algebras of sets isn't even a Boolean algebra of sets anymore. Rather, you take what is usually called sigma tensor sigma prime, which I'll describe in a moment. You take all the probability weights on that. This is the smallest sigma algebra containing sigma cross sigma prime. It's the sigma algebra generated by sigma cross sigma prime. And as an illustration of that, is this still visible over here? Not too much in the shadows? Okay. Imagine that we're taking, I don't know, say, the real line or some big interval on the real line, a Cartesian product, or rather a pair of measurable sets, say little a and little b, you know, you could naturally associate with this. Actually, it's the sigma algebra generated by, I should say, the set of all Cartesian products, a cross b, where little a is in sigma, little b is in sigma prime. That's what I meant there. So products of measurable sets are just little rectangles like that. But in this case, we want to throw in anything that is a countable union of such things, right? And when you do that with arbitrary choices of A and B, you get all sorts of, you know, regions like that. You can have, you know, very complicated, highly non-rectangular regions, and those get thrown in. So those are measurable sets, and they constitute outcomes in various possible ways of partitioning S cross S, S prime. They're all allowed. So again, you have way, way, way more outcomes than simply the ones that could be represented by ordered pairs. Okay? Okay, now, in spite of that, I was just instructed on how to use these. In spite of that, please. Good. As I was saying earlier, fun, but ultimately stupid. Yes. I want to be able to fling them around physically. It's just not as satisfying otherwise. In spite of the fact that these guys have, you know, much, much richer outcome sets than we would get from these ways of combining the models, we still have a connection. Note, in each case, we do have a mapping. Let me just call it, let me call it little pi, that goes from products of outcomes to outcomes of the composite in each of these examples. In the case of the quantum case, this is the mapping that sends an ordered pair of unit vectors, x and y, to their tensor product, which is a unit vector in H tensor K. Okay, does that make sense? Ordered pairs of outcomes correspond to pure tensors like that. In the classical case, it's the mapping that sends a pair of measurable sets A and B to their Cartesian product, that little rectangular thing over on the far board. And now let's think about what this map does. One thing that's not very hard to convince yourself of is that if you apply this map to, in either case, if you apply this map to a product test. So that would be a product of two orthonormal bases, pardon me, a Cartesian product of two orthonormal bases, right, in the quantum case, or it would be the Cartesian product of two partitions, one of measurable space S, one of measurable space S prime. Either way, what you get is something in the appropriate state space for what we're calling the composite. This would be true for all tests E in MA and F in MB. So let's just step that through in our heads. If I look at all of the product vectors, little x tensor, little y, where little x ranges over an orthonormal basis for H, little y ranges over an orthonormal basis for K, is that still an orthonormal basis for H tensor K? Yes, right? It's one of the first things you learn about tensor products. And if I take two partitions, and I look at all the Cartesian products like this, all the rectangular sets, let me just, you know, that is a partition, you can check that formally, but let's just, I'll do it over here, let's just notice that it would look something like this if I have a partition down here, and maybe a partition like that, then the image of this map of this cross this is just this sort of grid-like partition of the whole. So, yes, so partitions go to partitions under this map, pairs of partitions go to partitions. Another thing to notice is that we can use this map to take states on this model, in both the quantum and the classical case, and sort of pull them back along this mapping to joint probability weights on A cross B, we can do that by defining a mapping pi from states on AB to probability weights on A cross B. MA cross MB, I guess. Just by saying that pi star of a probability weight omega on the composite is just omega composed with pi, which is just a fancy way of saying that pi star omega of, say, ordered pair xy is omega of pi of xy, which would be omega of x tensor y in the quantum case, or omega of, say, A cross B, if omega is a measure and A and B are product sets. And those are going to add up to 1 over all of the product measurements, just because the product measurements went to measurements on the AB side. But more than that, in these two models, because of the way we chose AB, these two models over here, these are in fact non-signaling. It's well known that these quantum states, you know, density matrices on the tensor product of two Hilbert spaces give you a non-signaling state. Not hard to check. They are non-signaling, and more than that, they have the right conditional states. So in fact, they live in what earlier we were calling omega NS. In other words, the state space of A cross NSB. All right? So product measurements go forward to measurements in the composite, and states in the composite pull back to non-signaling states on A cross B. Those seem like two requirements that it would be reasonable to use in framing a general definition of a non-signaling composite, that you have a map pi that does this kind of work for you. You might have a much bigger outcome space. You might have lots and lots of, you know, experiments that aren't product experiments, but you should at least have, within all of that, you should at least have product experiments. And it should be the case that when you restrict states on the big thing to product experiments, you get non-signaling states. So I'll come back to that. But first, I want to extrapolate a little bit from what we did here and say, look, what we have here is some kind of a mapping, some kind of a way of translating from this simple model, A cross NSB, to this bigger model AB. Maybe we should talk about mappings between models. More generally, well, not more generally, I don't know why I keep saying that. The term of art here is morphisms. We're going to talk about morphisms of models. So suppose I have two models, A and B. And I want to set up some sort of a mapping of some sort that will take me from model A to model B in a nice way. What properties should it have? What kind of an object should it be? Well, I'm going to say that such an object, a morphism, is going to be, first of all, a way of taking outcomes of A to outcomes of B. So phi is going to be a function from outcomes to outcomes. And it's going to have these properties. The first property is that if I have two outcomes of model A and they are orthogonal, which remind you means that they are distinct outcomes of some common experiment. They can be told apart in a single measurement. Then I want that property to be preserved. So phi of x should be orthogonal to phi of y over here. Incidentally, that means that if I restrict phi to a single test where all of the outcomes are orthogonal, phi will be injective, right? Because I won't, you know, this, if phi of x equaled phi of y, then this would fail. So we could also say this is the condition that the mapping be locally injective on each test. By the way, that's satisfied over here. If the ordered pair xy is different from a different ordered pair x prime y prime, then I get different pure tensors or different Cartesian products. So that's not a big issue here. In fact, those maps over there are globally injective. They're just injective, full stop. Secondly, I want phi to take measurements to measurements. So phi of e is going to be in m of b for every e in m of a. And the final consideration is that when I compose this mapping with a state on b, which takes me to the reals, I should get a state on a. So for every beta, let's say, in the state space of b, I want phi star of beta, by which I mean beta composed with phi, to be in the state space of A. And that's it. Those are the conditions I'm going to impose. Now, I'm going to make a comment here, sort of for later reference. Maybe things we talk about in April will come back to this. This is a fairly strong definition of morphism, and there are weaker ones that you can use. In particular, the fact that tests go to tests, that's very strong. That's kind of related to the condition, say in quantum information theory, that you have normalization preservation. States go to fully normalized states, as we'll see, you know, perhaps a little bit later. So technically, this would be a test preserving morphism. And there are, as I say, weaker kinds, and you can see some of that discussed in the notes. Right. The more general condition is that when you apply phi to a full test on A, you might only get an event in B, but all of the events that arise that way should be equiprobable. in all of the states on B, so that you can pull states on B back at least to subnormalized states on A. And then there are some other generalizations. You can look at sort of event valued mappings and partial versions of this. But I don't need to go into any of that because this is plenty for our purposes today. Okay, so let me just stop for a minute. Everybody fairly happy so far? Okay, that's good. All right, so in terms of this new jargon, our mapping over here mapping pi gave us a mapping from the model, gave us a morphism from the model non-signaling A cross B to AB. In both cases, we had, in fact, a proper morphism. Yeah? Okay. I think we have a definition of a composite. A non-signaling composite of A and B is a pair AB, pi, like this, where pi is a morphism in this sense, a test-preserving morphism from the very minimal non-signaling composite of A and B that we constructed earlier into AB. That seems reasonable. It's reasonable to require at least that much, and we can get a good deal of mileage out of just that much, so I'm going to stop there. That's going to be the definition going forward. And if we want to add extra conditions, we will add adjectives. Okay, does that make sense? Any questions at this point?
So this definition is a more general one than those two.
Yes, because this allows for both of the examples that we developed earlier, the full quantum example looks like this, as we verified earlier, and so does the full measure theoretic classical example. It's an instance of this. So I'm basically just saying, you know, any instance of this scheme, we'll call that a composite, a non-signaling composite. Go ahead.
So to go beyond, let's say, the quantum, we can just relax a few of the properties of these morphisms and see what we get.
So there are two things you can do. Yes, so you can get a more general notion of composite if you relax some of the conditions on morphisms. Absolutely. And maybe we'll talk about that in April. But yes, that's one thing you can do. And that becomes interesting even when you're dealing with quantum models. Then you can get things like ways of coupling systems where the product of two, like one-dimensional projections, is a higher dimensional projection. It's not, you know, that actually happens with quaternionic quantum mechanics. When you couple quaternionic systems, the product of two rank one projectors ends up being, I think, like a rank four projector, if you do it right. So, you know, so weird things can happen, and those weird things are not, they're weird, but they're not unreasonable. They're there for a reason, and to accommodate some of those, you would need to loosen some of these conditions, and then you copy the definition, but with the weaker definition of morphism. The other way in which you can go beyond quantum mechanics, however, is you can just start to play with A and B and just say, well, what could it be? What kinds of things could we construct that would still, you know, accommodate this? Now, one thing to say before we proceed is just that according to this definition, A cross B and S, the non-signaling, this minimal non-signaling thing, is a composite, right? Because I could just use the identity morphism. And this is also a non-signaling composite. Yes? Because just because product tests are a sort of degenerate instance of these forward and backwards branching tests. Right? Like, you know, all of Bob's F sub X's might be the same. They might just be F. Okay, so that is good. And I think at this point, you know, the clock, it's a good point for me to stop for a moment, have some coffee, entertain a question, and then I want to talk about how you linearize all of this. Okay? Everything's okay so far? Questions? No? Okay, shall we linearize? Yes? Okay. So, let us do that. Okay. So, we know that any probabilistic model is associated with two ordered vector spaces, one that I call V of the model and then its dual. So, given model A, we have V of A, which is roughly the span of, well, indeed, is the span of the state space in R to the X. And then we have its dual, V star of A, which is just my not even shorthand, but just preferred way of writing that. So states live in V of A, and effects live here. Specifically, effects are functionals A from V to the reals, linear, that are positive. And have the feature that A applied to some alpha in omega is less than or equal to 1. There is a unit functional where this is an equality or unit effect. U, where U of alpha is identically equal to 1, again, for all alphas in the state space. And so saying that you have an effect is the same thing as saying that A is between 0 and U in the pointwise order, where you just order things by evaluation on states. So that's a little recap of the linearization thing that we went through. And now let's talk about morphisms. If I have a morphism, phi, from A to B, a test preserving, for us that's the case. I'll just note it, test preserving morphism. Then we have certainly this sort of dual map phi star that goes from omega of B back to omega of A. That was part of our definition of morphism, right? And therefore, if I have any effect, restricted to omega of A will give me sort of affine functional from omega of A down to the reals. Diagram here might be helpful. Here's omega of B. Here's omega of A. If I have an effect little a like that, then phi star composed with A also gives me an affine mapping there, right? And that's still going to be between 0 and 1 because this was. And so it'll define a new effect. So in fact, what we might call phi star star goes from effects to effects And it's not very hard to show that everything actually extends to the linear spaces that contain these things. So indeed, we have phi star going from V of B to V of A. I'm using the same letter. Technically, this is the extension of this, but there is only one linear extension, so I give it the same name. And then the dual of this, which I'll just call phi, why not, is a linear extension of phi from outcomes to effects and then to the entire dual. And this map has the important property that when you apply it to the unit effect on A, you get the unit effect on B. So let's just take a moment and check in with the more familiar quantum case. In the quantum case, in finite dimensions, these spaces are essentially both the space of all the linear operators on your Hilbert space, and these mappings are positive mappings that take the identity to the identity, right? Now, in quantum information theory, quantum mechanics more broadly, you don't use arbitrary such mappings. You use completely positive mappings. And that's another thing we could come back to talk about, perhaps. But in this setting here, our definitions so far don't place that sort of restriction, right? Presumably, we could, you know, consider any morphism, and we would just get some positive linear mapping that preserves the unit effect. Okay, so what about composites? What happens when we linearize our definition of a composite? We have a morphism. We can linearize it. So if AB is a composite, and we have our morphism from the minimal composite here to AB, then linearizing, we get a mapping from V star of A cross B, where the effects live, to V star of AB. That's sort of the linearized version. That will happen automatically just because pi is a morphism, and morphisms basically always linearize in this canonical way. And of course, pi star will also give us a mapping in the other direction from the sort of the linear state space, the space where the actual state space lives, back to this thing. So possibly a good place to start in asking what do these spaces look like in more detail, maybe it's to concentrate on this for a moment. What does the linear state space of this non-signaling composite look like? What does the span of the non-signaling states look like? And that turns out to be an interesting story because it connects with work that was done a long time ago, back in the early 70s, even late 60s, on tensor products of compact convex sets and of ordered vector spaces. And just to give you sort of the upshot of that, by the way, the sort of paper on this is by Namioka and Phelps, I think as long ago as maybe 1968. I'll just use an apostrophe because we haven't gotten to the next one, and it wouldn't plausibly be the one previous to the one I mean. So, okay. There's that paper, and then others around the same time. The upshot is if V and W are two ordered real vector spaces, I'll just say ordered vector spaces. And for the moment, let's just look at the finite dimensional case. It's going to be easier to state the thing I want to state in the finite dimensional case. Then there are two natural ways of putting an order that is identifying a cone on the tensor product of those two vector spaces. Let me just pause and make sure. Is everybody with me so far as to what I'm saying? You give me two ordered vector spaces. So V has a distinguished positive cone, W has a distinguished positive cone. The question is, what positive cone should I put on V tensor W? V tensor W is a standard algebraic object. I know what that is. But what cone do I choose? And it turns out there are sort of two extremal possible cones you can pick. One is called the minimal tensor cone, or it's called that nowadays. It used to be called the projective tensor cone, but it's neither here nor there. And here's what it looks like. It is just the cone spanned by things that look like alpha tensor beta, where alpha is in V plus, the cone of V, and beta is similarly in the cone of W. So you just say, I want products of positive things to be positive, and I want a cone, so I'll just add everything I need in addition to those to make a cone, and that's it, I'll stop. More concretely, this would be the set of all linear combinations, summation over some index I, scalar T sub I, alpha I tensor beta I, where the alphas and the betas are positive in their respective vector spaces, and the TIs are non-negative reals. So, positive linear combinations of products of positive vectors. Okay? And that's surely the smallest thing that you could plausibly use, hence the minimal cone. However, there is another cone that you could use, which is called, usually these days, the maximal tensor cone, according to which something in V tensor W should be positive if it acts positively on products of positive linear functionals. In terms of our linearized models, that's basically saying if it evaluates to a positive number on a product of effects, it should count as a positive thing in V tensor W. So this is the set of all tensors. I guess I'll just call it little omega in V tensor W, such that for all A in the dual cone, the positive dual cone of V, the positive cone of the dual of V, and for all beta in the positive dual cone of W, actually that would be a B, not a beta, sorry. A tensor B, that linear functional, evaluates to something non-negative on omega. Now, next question is, what's the connection between these two cones, the one to the other, and also what are the connections between those cones and what we've done over here? Well, let me see if I can do something fancy here. I will raise the middle board while lowering simultaneously the upper board. That worked, but I took my finger off of that one. Okay, so we can see that, and we don't need this anymore. So, all right, so here's a theorem, which is not super hard to prove. There's a little bit of a separation argument, if I remember. If you take the minimal tensor cone of two ordered vector spaces and thereby construct what we'll call the minimal tensor product of V and W, let me just insert here. When I talk about the minimal tensor product of two ordered vector spaces, I mean their tensor product with the minimal cone. Similarly, the maximal tensor product is just the tensor product with the maximal cone. Okay, space versus cone, that's all. This thing has a dual space, which also has an order. And you can ask, what does the dual cone of the minimal tensor product look like? What does the ordered dual space look like? Well, it turns out it is the maximal tensor product of the duals. So dualizing takes you from minimal to maximal, and it works in both directions. If you take the dual of the maximal ordered tensor product, you get the minimal one. Dualizing, in fact, exchanges minimal and maximal tensor products. Okay. Here's another theorem. originally due to Clay, Foulis, and Randall, and then souped up a little bit later by me. But the finite dimensional case is really their result. And it is that essentially that the cone of A cross NSB is the maximal cone. In other words, that this space is isomorphic in a canonical way to V of A maximal tensor V of B. Okay, I've tried to outline a little bit how that goes in the notes, and if people, you know, want to see more details, just let me know and I can flesh that out further. It turns out not to be a super hard argument. The original proof was by a kind of complicated dimension counting argument, and then later I was able to say that no, it's just multilinear algebra, and it's sort of clear. All right, but that's still a satisfying result. We have a sort of construction with test spaces and models, and it turns out that when you linearize it, you get a well-known off-the-shelf object in the theory of ordered vector spaces. Okay, because these guys have exactly the same state space, they have the same linearized state space. So this guy also has this maximal tensor product as its state space. Now, an immediate corollary then of this theorem and the previous one is that the dual ordered vector space, the one where the effects live, for the non-signaling product of A and B, or this other one, that's going to be isomorphic to the minimal tensor product of the duals of the two factors. Now, when you apply these two constructions to quantum systems, you do not get back the usual quantum mechanical spaces. You get back things that are, on the one hand, here, with the maximal tensor product, you get back a space that can be represented as a space of operators, but it is the space of all operators that are positive on pure tensors. When you trace the operator against a pure tensor of projections, you get something positive. And that is far, far larger than the usual cone of positive operators. Positive on pure tensors is a pretty weak condition. On the other hand, just because it is so big, it allows all kinds of entanglement. It allows all the entangled states that you'd have in quantum theory, and it allows even sort of more entangled states, super post-quantum entanglement, if you like. the bad news is that when you start looking on the effect side in the quantum case, you get something that is radically smaller than the usual positive cone. And so that means that you do not have all the effects that you like. And in particular, you can show you don't have any entangled effects. No entangled effects at all. Okay. Right? So another reflection of the fact that this composite is not really adequate for most purposes. Okay. Let me make one other quick comment. I don't know if this clock cannot be right, since it tells us that we are not quite 5 minutes past.
It is right.
It is right.
It's right.
Well, it's 1 hour.
Okay. As long as it's shifted, you know, in a clean way by an hour, then we're all right. All right. One other little theorem I'm going to mention, which is kind of cool and is hard, and also recent. This is due to Todd Aubron and Ludovico Lami and Palazuelos, I think, is on it, and Martin Plavala is also on it. So it's by these guys. And it asks the question, when are the minimum and maximum, minimal and maximal tensor products the same?
This is the entangling cones.
Yeah, exactly. So you could ask this question, when are these guys the same? When are these two cones the same? And one direction has been known since ancient times, the late 1960s. If V or W is classical, by which I basically mean the base of the cone is a simplex, then these will collapse. So if either factor is basically representing a classical system, they come out to be the same. But it was not known whether the reverse implication held until comparatively recently. It does, because of this paper, which, when did that come out? Like 2000, I want to say it was maybe just before COVID, so like 18 or 19, 2018, 2019, 2020, somewhere in that range. So fairly recent result. Okay. So one other thing I want to mention about composites that is kind of important. You might notice that although we talked about this mapping pi that takes sort of productive pairs of outcomes to what you might call product outcomes, we haven't talked about products of states. Like maybe Alice can prepare a state alpha, Bob can prepare a state beta, and you'd like to say the whole system is now in a state, I don't know, alpha tensor beta or something like that. To do that, you need to actually add a condition on the definition of a composite. So this is actually in the literature usually just baked into the definition, but I think I want to separate them. So I'm going to call this a strong composite. That's one in which for all alpha in omega of A and beta in omega of B, you have a sort of unique, not unique necessarily, but canonical. There exists a canonical alpha tensor beta in omega of AB, like this, okay? So that's an extra condition that you have to add if you want it. Almost all the composites that you meet in practice do satisfy this condition. But I think it's prudent to just leave on the table that there might be ways of composing systems in which you can't prepare the two systems independently. I think you should always be able to measure them independently, but preparation might not be quite as easy. Okay, I'm actually realizing that I've omitted something that I will be privately embarrassed to having omitted. But since we're short of time, let me stop and just stop with what I had been talking about and give you the very briefest preview of what I think is a really exciting thing to talk about, because it's very new and it seems to go far. And that's the question of what do you actually mean when you talk about a probabilistic theory? We've been talking about probabilistic models, right? One at a time, or maybe two at a time. But what could we mean by a probabilistic or a general probabilistic theory? Well, one answer, what's a GPT? Right, after five lectures, we should finally get to answer that question. What is a GPT? A standard answer, call this answer one, is the following. You can say, okay, we have this notion of models. We have a notion of mappings between models or morphisms. It's pretty clear that the composition of morphisms is a morphism, and it's pretty clear that the identity map on any outcome set is a morphism. Oh, that means we have a bunch of objects, bunch of morphisms, morphisms composed, there are identity morphisms. Say that again.
Category.
Yes, we have a category. So we have a category, let's just call it prob for the moment, of probabilistic models and morphisms. And actually, we're going to have different versions of this depending on which axioms for morphisms we choose. Right? We could tinker with the definitions. So maybe I'll call it prob one if they're test preserving, like they have been here. And then maybe more generally and more vaguely, prob. So one answer is maybe it's just a subcategory of prob. It's just a category of probabilistic models and morphisms. Maybe that's a probabilistic theory. All right? Here's the answer that I think is more interesting, better in some ways. I don't think it should be a subcategory. I think rather it should be a functor. For those of you who know this lingo, I think it should be a functor from a category of physical systems and processes, a process theory, as some of the literature has it, to probabilistic models, so that every physical system has a model. And if you have a process that connects two systems, that should give you a morphism between the models. Now, the interesting process theories come with a tensor product. This will be answer three, I guess. You might have what is called a monoidal, or better yet, maybe a symmetric monoidal category for your process theory. And in that case, what you can do is you can ask that your functor, well, here we have a problem. There's no unique tensor product on this side. What you can do is you can define one. You can define f of a, f of b to be f of a tensor b. You take the product in the category of physical systems and processes, you compose, and then you associate a model. And for that to make sense, this has to be well defined. The easiest way to make this well defined, and I think this is a reasonable requirement anyway, is to say that this functor here should be injective on objects. Distinct physical systems get distinct models. Maybe isomorphic models, but you know, you can tell them apart. Okay, and then with that, this becomes a well-defined thing, and then you would want to insist that it be a non-signaling composite. And since I'm really running out of time, I'll stop writing in order to force myself to quit. But the way you would make those non-signaling composites is you'd have to have appropriate little pi morphisms, one for every a and b. You'd get a natural transformation between a pair of functors, which I will describe some other time, but I clearly am out of time.